Chariot Conference Sessions podcast, episode number 4, Chariot's Joel Confino on ensuring competitive advantage with continuous integration. These conference sessions are hosted by Chariot Solutions. We are a project-based consulting, mentoring, and training firm working on technologies such as enterprise application development and integration, mobile applications on iOS, Android, mobile web, and other platforms, and more. Visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com. And by Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise, Chariot's premier conference held on April 2nd and 3rd, 2013. Speakers will discuss innovative technologies, techniques, and emerging trends in software development. Meet leaders in fields such as Scala, data science, JavaScript application platforms, and much more. Register before February 15th and save. Visit phillyemergingtech.com. Joel Confino is a longtime consultant at Chariot Solutions. He spent the last 4 years working at a large enterprise, here named ABC Corporation, rolled out a new development platform and build process. Joel was one of two speakers at our event, which also included Sonatype's Jason Van Zyl. Joel's focus was in building competitive advantage by choosing to implement continuous integration tools such as Maven, Nexus, Jenkins, and Sonar. Let's give him a listen.
And I'm going to talk about building competitive advantage. So everybody kind of starts out the same way, the manual build and deploy. You know, you kind of mess around with your code and you build it and then you hack it onto your production server. And we're all way beyond that step. Then almost everybody's in this continuum now of a semi-automated build and deploy. So some things are automatic, you have some scripts. Some things are manual, but it's far from the model of I check in code, I push a button, and it's on production. I mean, you know, that's almost laughable at a giant organization, you know, with a huge website. But that's where everybody wants to get, I think. That's really where we want to get. Like a lot of the things that we do is manual processes. Anytime a person gets involved, basically you fail because something's going to go wrong, human error. Anytime to get a production build that we need to have some sort of workflow and multiple groups got to get involved and we have, you know, discussions and meetings and eventually we have a production website, you know, a new version of our production website gets deployed, we fail. So fully automated build and deploy is really where we're headed. And so really when I think about it, you're building two systems. You're building your system, like your production website, you know, and you're also building your delivery system, which is the system that's going to take your production website, build it, and actually deploy it. And so a lot of focus is obviously done on application architecture and, you know, Ruby on Rails and Spring, Roo, and, you know, you've got Django with Python, lots of ways to build applications faster or to create software faster. But we have really kind of been stuck in the Stone Ages for a while on actually building that. And we've kind of, I think, the build infrastructures have gotten much better recently. But then even beyond that, as we look towards continuous delivery, which is deploying that quickly. Now this talk's going to, so really when I think of delivery system, I think of it's build and deploy. In this talk, we're going to talk about the build infrastructure. The delivery infrastructure is extremely interesting as well. I think that's kind of where Jason touched on Provisio, Chef, Puppet, and actually a lot of things there are more under development and there's a lot of new ideas and the path is not as clear, although it's interesting. But to even get to there, I think your build infrastructure, which we're going to talk about, your foundation has to be correct or you're not going to be able to do it. And again, the end goal is my developer makes a change and I can have it on my production website in an hour or two. And you know, again, at many organizations that are big, that's crazy talk because a change makes it into production in like literally months, certainly not in weeks, and definitely not in days, and no way in an hour. But that's changing. And as a consultant going to a lot of large clients in the Philadelphia area, that's changing at big companies where people are deciding that we can do stuff at the, you know, at quote unquote Google speed. Or if you look at a company called Etsy, they have a thing on their website where they deploy 25 times to production a day. And again, that actually sounds ludicrous to me, but it can be done when you take people out of the equation and you're, again, you have these two systems, your software, your website, and this system, this incredibly tuned system that builds and deploys your software. And right now, we don't even think of it that way. We think of build and deployment as a bunch of servers, some scripts, and a couple guys, and we all get on a big conference call, hold hands, and pray that when we start up the website, you know, everything works. And that's kind of horrific if we call ourselves engineers. So what I'm going to talk you through is a case study where we really did this, laid this foundation, and the name of the client is not AcmeSoft, obviously. The names have been changed to protect the guilty. This is a true, you know, this is drawn from real experience, but this may look like many pieces of many of your companies and kind of show how you can sort of refactor your build infrastructure to go from clunky or ancient to something that you really can now set the stage for continuous deployment or some of these more advanced ways of building. So at AcmeSoft, they had things that are very typical. A monolithic code base, so lots of humongous modules rather than small little modules that are focused. An ancient version control system, an old build system, which was a centralized team that ran all the builds. So the developers had no idea how to run a build. Like, what's that? I mean, that's that build team. I don't even care. These other guys do it, and man, I'm glad it's not my job. And so the developers weren't even really sure how the software gets built. What they built on their desktop and their PCs didn't really resemble what got built in production. And the feedback loop on whether the entire build worked or not was, ridiculously long. Like, maybe it was built once a week and everybody got a big email like, you broke it. And then it took several days to set up a new project. I'm sure you've seen this one. Like, you get onto a new project, you're like, okay, how do I start? Ooh, well, let me try to remember. And then, okay, you need this file. And then wait, Bob is the only one who knows how to do this. Bob, come here. How do we set up this project again? So, it's this custom work of art and multiple days, and then you can sort of build it. And then no visibility to code quality. If it compiles, we're going to ship it. So, these are really common problems. So the first step in kind of in building out, getting to an advanced build system is to modernize the tool chain. And actually, let me just hit this so I know how long I'm talking. The first thing that we did was replace the old version control system with Subversion, or if we had done it now, it might have been Git. This may sound silly, like, yeah, we want to be talking about something advanced, why are you talking about version control systems? But as you find out, like, all these things have to be in place, and we'll kind of talk about why. You want to get to continuous delivery, or you want to get to really high-tech deployment, you actually have to start all the way back with your version control system, because it all is interplayed. So if you have an older version control system, if you in your mind, when I said version control system, think, oh gosh, not that. It may be time to look at something better that can handle, because we'll talk about a little bit why that matters. They replaced the old build system with the Ant build system with Maven. So why do I like Maven? What are some of the things that it gives you? The standard project structure. Again, it sounds really basic, but we'll get into why that's important. Every project, you don't get to pick the directory structure. This is the directory structure, because you might call it this and you might call it that, but at the end of the day, a standard project structure. When you have thousands of builds, this kind of stuff starts to matter. A one-line build, Maven install. I don't have to do some sort of custom. If your build is more than one step, that's a fail. It needs to be one-liner. And the dependency management. The dependency management is huge. Back in the good old days, you might have had a lib directory, you checked into version control, the different jars that your project needed, and guess what? You deployed the wrong jar to production. It happened. And you had, or maybe you got your jars off a network drive. That's another popular one. And somebody put the wrong version onto the network drive, and you deployed the wrong jar to production. Because let's face it, if your web app's huge, you might have 100 jars that go along with that thing. You can never quite keep it straight. The dependency management is really, really huge, I think, into being able to build modular software. And if you don't have dependency management, that's why you build monolithic software, is one of the reasons. I mean, monolithic is certainly the easiest way to go, but if I don't have a good way to manage it, then I don't want to have a lot of pieces because they're really a pain to manage. If I want to take something and have focused modules that are cohesive, I'm going to end up with a lot of modules if I have a big code base. And it's going to be a real pain to try to copy them to a network drive or something. So the dependency management solution is really important, I think, to writing good software. And one of the keys to writing good software is modularity. That's one of the things that gets missed a lot. And the other thing in modernizing the toolchain initial step is when you bring in Maven, you definitely want to get a local Maven repository. Central is the big Maven repository in the sky, but you want to have your local Maven repository to put your software, because the same reason why Maven Central is beneficial to pull in third-party software, it's that you want to be able to use it to pull in, to have projects within your company use each other in the same way. Because again, you're trying to go from perhaps one giant monolithic jar or a couple giant monolithic jars to a whole bunch of focused cohesive jars, and then pull each other, and Maven pulls them all in from your own local repository. Again, just really quick, I assume many of you know this, so I'll go quickly, but a Maven repository in general is just kind of like version control for jars, wires, and years. And so it's going to contain, like I mentioned, both your stuff and third-party stuff, and it kind of allows you to, it's one point of control for what third-party jars you use and enter into your company. Depends on your company, but in the ones that I've been with, it's very important to not deploy a jar to production that has the wrong open source license. And with the Insight product that Jason was talking about, which sounds actually fabulous, the information being able to tell you what jars you use that have security flaws, which is almost impossible to figure out. You know, just hope you happen to get the email. And the licensing are big. So having your own Maven repository at least allows you to give you a place to kind of whitelist what you use. This is Nexus. So Nexus I would highly recommend. I'm going to recommend a couple products that ISCOM's an open source or professional, but I've used Nexus for about the past 5 years. It's been very solid. Maven repository, and so this is what it looks like. I realize you really can't see it very much, but it's just a list of versioned artifacts, basically. So why would I pick Nexus over just a regular? A Maven repository can be as simple as a web server, and I've done it that way before. You throw on Apache, put it in the right directory structure, it's a Maven repository. So what do you get when you put something else on top of it like a Nexus? Well, these are the things that I like. Security, you can allow. It's not as much read security, because in many cases you want everybody to be able to download the stuff, but it's who can actually put things into your repository, because if you're trying to have a secure chain of custody, like I actually want to know what gets into production and somebody can't put in like a malicious jar, then you can't just have everybody free for all being able to publish into Nexus. Because in reality, publishing into Nexus is almost like publishing into production. Eventually it's going to get there. So when you use Maven, when you use an internal repo, security is important. The searching is important. You can put in a class and you can find out what jars it's in. Nexus allows you to group many physical repositories. You can group them logically into one. And the reason that that's nice is, as a Nexus admin, I can change kind of the physical way that I lay things out. But to the users who have a Maven settings file, who have these things hard-coded in them, the URLs never change. So that's just like a little piece of adminning that if you did with Apache, it would be a pain. Nexus is scalable. We run the high hundreds, maybe low thousands of builds a day. It doesn't blip. I mean, it's basically like a web service. A web service scales super well. Purging old snapshots is important in Maven. You're going to get a lot of stuff that comes into Nexus, especially snapshot builds. If you're using a web server, you've got to figure out how to get rid of old snapshots, or they'll just keep piling up. And Nexus has purge policies that allow you to say, just keep the last 10. It has a REST API, which you use all the time to integrate it. So if you want to have, for instance, I want to have another system watch Nexus, and when an artifact gets uploaded, something happens, you can watch the REST API. And Nexus is extensible. I've written plugins for it. The one that I like, or the one that I found very useful, is I wrote a reverse dependency plugin for Nexus. So if you give it a jar, or if you give it an artifact, it'll tell you all the things that are using that artifact. So that was important for, we want to retire a jar. We want to finally get rid of this thing. Because in a big company, it's not how much you're putting into your source control, how much you're putting into Nexus, how much you're taking out. Because you fall under your own weight of software. It just keeps piling up year after year. You're really trying to get rid of the old stuff. And so, you know, I was able to write a plugin fairly easily. You can extend the rest of it. So we went from fairly crusty, old build system when only one team knew what was going on, to something that looks like this. The developer has Maven on their PC, they have Subversion, and they have Nexus. This is probably not unfamiliar to many of you, but this actually is important, because now, in a large company with thousands of projects, I can build any project in the company with two commands. Subversion, check out the URL, Maven, install. That's a huge accomplishment if you didn't have that before and every project was a custom work of art. So this is really, you know, speaks to repeatable builds. So that's kind of like the first level. It might seem like, wow, that was pretty basic. So then we kind of move on top of that. And the next one is to implement continuous integration. So the next step on top of that is to pick a CI server. I'd recommend Jenkins. There's a lot of them out there. There was Hudson, there was Jenkins. They had a fight, they split. I think Hudson won the war. That's just my opinion, I don't know. But I like Jenkins. It's a good product. It's one of the things I like about Jenkins and Nexus, and another thing we're going to talk about Sonar, is this kind of new breed of tools. They're basically zero install. You download them, you unzip them, you run them. They have beautiful UIs. This is common to all of them. They're easy to admin, so it's not like you need to download this giant thing and you need to hire a consultant to install it. And it's like, you know, I don't know. I always get goofed up when I install Oracle. But this, maybe it's just me, but this is easier. You know, these are easy to install to admin. So you get a CI server like Jenkins, and you create a job for every single project you have in Subversion, or your repository. So you have all these modules. Each of them has a URL in Subversion. Each of them has a corresponding job in Jenkins. So Jenkins sits there and watches Subversion for changes. Whenever something changes, it builds the project, runs the tests. You get a rapid feedback loop. I call Jenkins like the intern you hired to just sit there and watch Subversion and download stuff and run it and email you if there's a problem. It's very, very basic, but that feedback loop is really, really important. Because, well, this is Jenkins. So if you haven't seen it, which again, I know most of you probably have seen some sort of CI server. You've got all your projects, you see blue lights, if they're passing, red lights, if they're failing, and you get a nice little weather icon to show how, whether they're passing or failing recently. So why do I like Jenkins? It's zero install. This is zero install. java-jar-jenkins.org. That's it. It runs. It's easy to administer. It has security that integrates with LDAP. It's scalable because it has master-slave instances. So we started, with Jenkins running on a PC, just when we were starting with a couple builds. And now we have it running on some super boxes where we're running thousands of builds, but we can add, it has master-slave concept built into it. So we just keep adding on slave nodes. We can add on Windows nodes, and most of them are Linux. So it's really a nice, flexible tool that kind of grows with you. Worth the thousands, low thousands of builds a day volume. So I can't give you above that, but it's still reasonably, high amount of volume. It has a huge number of plugins, so pretty much a lot of different things you can think of. It has a REST API and it's extensible. I've written a large number of Jenkins plugins internally, which I can talk to you about afterwards. If you're interested, there's some things that we found that they were really nice. But one of them was, for instance, a plugin that runs after every build. So it's a build post-processor. It takes the timings for each build and it hits a REST API, which is a Grails app, which stuffs them in a database. But basically, it gives us a really simple operational dashboard where we can run a query and say, are any of my builds across my entire Jenkins cluster starting to get slower? So operationally, we can start to figure out whether the infrastructure is getting slower, whether individual builds are getting slower. It's just one example of plugins, but there's a lot you can do with Jenkins. So now our build infrastructure looks like this. We've got Maven, Subversion, and Nexus, and now we've added in Jenkins. And notice kind of the dotted lines. When you're on a PC, you're reading from Nexus. When you're on Jenkins, you're reading from Subversion, but you're not really writing back to that. So we've eliminated, Jenkins does make tags in Subversion, but that's not really perhaps, so there's a little writing, but it's not changing code. So again, the workflow is the developer changes code in Subversion, but builds that go to Nexus only happen from Jenkins. So we've kind of separated out how you get code in Subversion and how you get compiled artifacts into Nexus. And Jenkins is the build service. So now I can start to break up that big ball of mud that I have, which is my giant monolithic code base. And the reason I can do that is we go back to here. For one thing, I've got this big ball of mud. Well, I'm going to almost say that until you get to something like this, you're stuck with the monolithic thing, and it's really tough to break it up. For one thing, you need a version control system that allows you to do refactoring, that allows you to do branching and merging sanely. And some of the older version control systems, change is difficult. Renaming directories is not particularly easy, and things like that. So that's one of the reasons you can break up your big ball of mud, because you can actually start to refactor the code and not have to fight with it in your version control system so much. The other reason you can refactor it is now you've got Nexus, you have dependency management. You can take one big thing, turn it into 100 little things, but you don't collapse under the weight of, I have 100 little things to manage. You have a dependency management tool which helps you manage all these little things. And then the third reason why now you can start to break up that monolithic software is you've got Jenkins, which is going to give you that continuous feedback loop. Because now if I'm starting to change things rapidly, I'm going to introduce errors and things are going to break. So I can't have everybody in my company go off and work like crazy and change a bunch of things and only find out once a week when they all screw up, when we do our big build at the end of the week. Now with Jenkins, I'm doing builds continually, so I'm going to find out much more rapid feedback loop. That's important. So I'd say, would you get those three pieces, a version control system that allows you to do refactoring, a dependency management system that allows you to break things up, and a continuous integration system that gives you rapid feedback, those three pieces in your build infrastructure, now you're actually ready to start refactoring software. Break up the big ball of mud. And then step three to add to that is metrics. And so now I'd recommend adding in the Sonar server. And again, this is a progression that we did at this company to kind of enhance things. So Sonar is an open source metric server, which I'll show you a little bit of. It's very good and it follows the same characteristics as the other ones. It's easy to install, it's easy to admin, it has a beautiful UI out of the box. And with Sonar, I'd recommend configuring it to gather metrics for every single build. And this is how we have it configured. So every time a Jenkins build runs, during that Jenkins build, it also gathers metrics with Sonar. And the other thing I'd recommend is, this is not the default way Sonar works, you can make it work this way, is that you fail the build, if metrics are not in line with the thresholds that you want. And so, for instance, if you have a policy that code coverage has to be 80%, you can do one of two things. You can not fail the build, and you can let people check in code, and you can have code coverage be whatever it is, 50%. And you can send them emails for the next 100 weeks in a row, please increase your code coverage, please increase your code coverage. If you don't increase your code coverage, we're going to fire you. You can try to coerce people, but it really doesn't happen, is my experience. If you fail the build, then that's the best way to stop it. Then you're not going to have code that doesn't meet your quality thresholds ever make it into production. So the so hooking it in so that it actually is part of the feedback loop that Jenkins gives, I think is really important. So this is Sonar. How many of you use Sonar now, just out of curiosity? So a good number use Sonar. It gives you a dashboard, and the dashboard gives you code quality. So just out of curiosity, how many of you actually have it fail the build? I don't know if that's a cool, interesting. And how many of you have it run, I guess, what's the frequency? Do you have it run, is it hooked in to run with Jenkins?
It's, this one we do once every night, for the main thing. Because so we need to run tests, and when we do this, we run both the unit tests and the integration tests. Mm-hmm. And if you run the integration tests, it's going to take you about an hour to run the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You can't have that.
Sure. Okay, yeah, so the answer was, in this case, it runs Sonar at night, so daily feedback cycle, and the reason is because it runs not just unit tests, it runs integration tests, and the integration tests take longer, so that can't be hooked into the unit test or drives the build time up, so that's interesting. Anybody else have another Sonar configuration?
We actually do the same thing because of the expensive integration tests. We have a subset of our integration tests that run on our CI server, we use Intel Pro, and then Sonar runs every night for metrics.
Okay, so same kind of thing where some of the integration tests run during the build, but they can't all run because of time. That makes a lot of sense. So Sonar, just kind of a little bit more depth into what it does, it wraps a bunch of other open source tools. So it wraps PMD and CheckStyle and FindBugs, and an advantage is that you don't have to configure all those for your project. You just configure Sonar, and under the covers, it runs all these things. And for the code coverage tool, there's at least two options. And so that's definitely something to be. Jococo, that Sonar uses Jococo now, and that's the Ecolemma guys wrote Ecol. They wrote Emma, then they wrote Cobatura, and then they wrote Jococo. Okay. It's this strange progression of
the names are crazy. Jococo is a new version of Cobatura?
Yeah. Cobatura is out, Jococo's in, and Jococo is actually a lot faster. Cobatura runs twice in your Maven build, and really Jococo only runs once. So it instruments a different way. I'm not exactly sure how, but okay. Yes, and the Jococo, on a totally sidebar, found it to be very fast, but one issue is that if you specify an arg line in Surefire, this is really kind of getting off the beaten path, but there's an arg line you can use in Surefire, which some of our developers use to increase the memory for Surefire because they write some kind of crazy tests. That arg line you specify in Surefire actually wipes out the arg line set by Jococo, and then you get no code coverage. So I won't say that it's been, to your point, without hiccups. Like, there are some things to work on. We had to exclude drools. Drools just gives Jococo trouble. I don't know exactly why. It's okay, because we're not trying to get the code coverage of drools. We're trying to get the code coverage of the code that we wrote. But there's probably a little fiddling there, for sure. In our scenario, we're actually running Sonar after every single build. Performance has been good enough that we can do that, and it gives us metrics every build. Our developers really like it because they used to run Sonar nightly. So what would happen is your CI job would run, and then it would put a message in a queue, and then at night it would check your project out from Subversion, and it would run a batch process would read that queue, and it would run Sonar, which is a Maven plugin, so it's like Maven Sonar, and it would put your metrics into Sonar. But that nightly delay, even though prior to this we didn't have any metrics, once they got used to seeing the metrics, they really wanted them kind of on demand. So by hooking it into the build, that worked out pretty well. So Sonar is a Maven plugin, and when you run it, you can run it from the command line, although it's not particularly easy on a developer PC. But what about IDE integration? Because a lot of people use an IDE, and I've struggled with that, or we've been working with that at the client that I'm at now. And kind of the solution is Sonar has an Eclipse plugin, but it's kind of has been for a while wretched. It took about a year. They made a Sonar plugin, and about a year they hadn't updated it. And so we actually contacted Sonar Source and was like, hey, what's up with this? We've got a bunch of developers that use IDEs. What's your direction? So what they told us was that they've hired somebody to just focus on the IDE. And now they've actually gave us three new releases. They gave us a kind of a timeline of what they're planning on doing. So I guess the long and the short of it is, between now and March, they have several large new releases planned for this IDE and Sonar or IDE plugin. They call it Sonar IDE. It's really a Sonar Eclipse plugin. And I found Sonar Source to be very accurate. When they give you a date, they don't slip. Like if they say December, they're going to give it to you December. So they said by March, they're going to, what's that?
They're Swiss.
Yeah, they're Swiss. They're precise. I mean, come on, just don't even question them once. So,
Do you know if they're doing an IntelliJ plugin?
I don't know that. And the guy told me, and they were pretty responsive. He said that basically when they created this, they didn't envision IDE being important. But when they started to find out, talk to enterprise customers, they found out, hello, lots of people use them. So, so the IDE support for Sonar should get much better. But right now, we use a combination of the Sonar IDE, which is, again, fairly horrific, and the Echo Emma plugin for code coverage, and that works relatively well. But a few things, we've talked a lot about Sonar, but it's easy to install. Again, you unzip it and run it. It has a nice-looking dashboard. It wraps a lot of the open-source tools, and that really cuts down on the configuration. It has a large number of plugins. I've written Sonar plugins myself, too, and they're fairly easy to write, because you may have custom metrics. That's another big thing. Like, you actually might care about some crazy metrics that aren't in the tools, and Sonar makes it pretty easy to include your own metrics. It has a REST API, and it's extensible. The REST API is pretty important, because now imagine that we, you know, this large company with thousands of projects, every single build gets metrics taken from it and put into Sonar, the central repository. That's like really valuable information that we didn't have before. So one way to use it is the Sonar dashboard, which it provides, but that, it, while very good, is only one view of this metrics information. And we actually, in this company, wanted to make Sonar be the system of record for metrics. So we have other dashboards, Cognos and different things, management dashboards, actually source their data from Sonar, and they use the REST API to get it. So I think Sonar, regardless of whether you like the screens, and they're pretty cool, but even if you don't, you can gather this data, and it keeps a historical, it tracks your metrics trending over time, and use it as a repository, and import it into management dashboards and other things. So I think it actually is really valuable, and if you set it up with part of your Jenkins builds, it's just part of the build process. So, you know, not only does the build process compile your software and run your tests, it actually gathers metrics and stores them in a historical repository. So now we've got a build system that looks like this. This is really what I think is, you know, a pretty complete build infrastructure. We have Maven, you've got Subversion, Nexus, Jenkins, which is running Maven, and Sonar. So now I can eliminate technical debt. With Sonar, you can actually track different aspects of your software, like cyclomatic complexity. You can track Bob Martin's OO metrics. You can see cyclomatic dependencies between your modules. And you can really start to take a giant code base where you're not going to be able to do code reviews of the whole thing if you have, you know, 40 million lines of code, but you can use a tool that can actually cut through that. And there are other tools like Structure 101 and things that allow you to do nice ad hoc work evaluating your source tree or your code base. But the problem with those are, you know, they're just sort of you ad hoc importing source. And where Sonar is going to run part of your build, it's automatically capturing everything. So you're capturing, you know, metrics for every line of code your company writes. And it's actually very achievable. It's not like this is, you know, all these products work pretty well, and they're all open source. So how has AcneSoft improved? And this change is in a giant organization. This has been a multi-year effort. You know, it hasn't, like, we just didn't do this in an afternoon or something like that, and change is slow. But the monolithic code base, you know, monolithic code base is going to stick around for a long time. I'm not going to say this has been refactored. This code base will be here for our children's children. You know, 20 million lines of code just don't refactor themselves. But pieces are being split off and put into modules because there's a dependency management system. New projects are not going into the giant ball of mud. They're going into their own modules. And then the ancient version control system was replaced with Subversion. So now refactoring is not so terrifying. The old build system was replaced with Ant. So now we have this very, you know, with Maven, we've got like I mentioned, repeatable builds. Every project's the same. I can check out any project in the company and have it up and built in, you know, just minutes. Check it out, build it. I don't have to do anything fancy set up on my machine. This centralized team that runs all the builds, the weekly feedback loop, they're kind of like the Maytag repairman. They don't really have a lot to do now because the developers are responsible for their own builds. So developers have their Hudson jobs and they get immediate feedback loop. So we're kind of limiting this manual process like, hey, team over there, can you build my software? And team over there who doesn't know anything about the software tries to build it. And then they email back, hey, developers over there, we don't know why this stuff doesn't work. And then, you know, there's kind of a lot of manual steps that don't need to be there. Now developers are working directly with Jenkins. They're responsible for their own builds and getting the feedback loop. And then, you know, again, instead of taking several days to set up a project, it takes several minutes. And instead of having no visibility into code quality to compile, ship it, we now have visibility plus that quality is enforced by the build. And I can't emphasize that enough. We've kind of found if you have a large developer population, after the fact reporting does very little good. Everybody's busy. Project deadlines win every single time. So that's, again, why you have to pretty much fail the build if you want to. And, hey, I'm as guilty of that as anybody as a developer. So, again, just in summary, you know, a delivery system is build plus deploy. And what we showed there was the build infrastructure, what I think being, you know, modernized and being ready for now a modern deployment system, which would be something like continuous delivery, which is an entirely different talk. But I think this is laying the foundation so that now you can achieve the next level, which is I check in code, I push a button, it's on production. That whole loop took like an hour. Questions, comments? Is anybody doing this? Is anybody doing a different variation of this? Can anyone repudiate this?
Here's my question is, since you're talking about an actual client, not to change the hearts and minds, we've had, I mean, since I've been at my company, we've had subversions, we've had Maven, like that, but they refuse to use, like, to use it, to, you know, I mean, it's been a year since we've been on Maven 3, and none of the developers are updating their POM files to eliminate reporting for everything, the plugins and stuff like that. They love to branch for projects. They're even going to be delivering the same thing. So like, since you did this time, how did you try to enforce that, the change of culture rather than up to the technology.
Sure.
They don't want to do anything different.
I wish I could say I had a great answer, but change management in large companies is tough. So much is cultural. We've had, for the success that we've had, it's really come from key managers, key development managers, buying into the vision for it, and then being able to say things like, so my team controls the developer tools, so we are responsible for Hudson, and we're responsible for, well, Jenkins now, and Nexus, and all these tools. So it's being able to convince a manager high enough up to say, we're just going to drop support from Maven 2 on the CI builds. I will say there's one point of control or leverage that you have, which is those CI builds. Like, if everything has to go through Jenkins to get anywhere, then if Jenkins doesn't support it, it ain't happening. So if you say, for instance, and actually we're in kind of this, I'm in sort of this battle too, I want to just get rid of Maven 2 on the Jenkins servers. And then basically, do you know how I'll know you're using Maven 3? Because you won't have anything in production unless you're using Maven 3. You know, it's so I really think it's that, but it is not easy because there isn't, often it's not enough to convince the grassroots. You know, for some of these changes, you have to just convince a manager high enough who says, at this point in time, you know, in 3 months from now, we're just getting rid of, you know, these jars and Nexus. Like, that's how we retire stuff. Like, you know, this old library that we've been maintaining for 10 years is horrific. We want to get rid of it. And in 3 months, we're yanking it out of Nexus, and your build will crash and burn if you haven't converted your POM. I don't know of a gentler way to do it.
Yeah, that's why, because a lot of stuff we have, I had Hudson installed and Nexus installed, and I did that all in slot.
Mm-hmm.
We were building a company where they fought me on Hudson, and we said, okay, so it's going to be our new standard. And that's what I wanted to do, but then I get to that. Like, why is it build failing now?
This took about 5 years, what I'm talking about. And it could have been compressed, but the client that I had was at a very conservative, slow-moving. So the pace definitely frustrated me, and it took a while to actually win the battle that this was valuable. I mean, some of the things are capabilities that you can't get. Sonar actually has really increased the pace. When Sonar appeared, the CIO saw and said, holy cow, I can finally figure out what you guys are doing. And then boom, everybody was like, oh yeah, we're doing Maven, sure. You know, because like all of a sudden the CIO likes it, and everybody falls in line. But sonar helped because it's very visual and it's something that you don't have otherwise. So maybe if you add sonar in there and you say, hey, look, guys, now you can actually see what's happening.
Yeah, it's a trend.
For integration tests, the kind of integration tests that we've introduced have been Selenium tests. So they've been, and Selenium is, and we actually haven't hooked it into the Maven lifecycle. So maybe we haven't used it maybe in the appropriate way. Selenium tests I found have really sold themselves. This has actually been a selling point to the CI infrastructure. So we had web developers who said, okay, if you've got people who are writing business logic, because this company divided up the business logic people, back end, front end, right? So the people who are writing the business logic, they've got JUnit, so they can kind of prove in a way that their stuff works. But then you get into web development, and until very, very recently, web development, the testers have been, well, how do you know, or the, not the testers, they have scripts and they have tools, but developers have had zero way of testing their own stuff. It's been, how do you know it works? Well, I clicked around on the web page, it seemed to work, right? Well, I mean, this is a practice at a giant company for a very, very long time. However, what happens is, you know, these are the same developers who get called in on Saturday and have been when their stuff breaks. So these developers are like, please, if you can help us to not get called in on Saturday, we'll do whatever crazy stuff you ask. And so we introduced Selenium and showed them how you can write JUnit style tests to test your web applications. And then, you know, you won't get called in on Saturday. Like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. Like, I haven't had any kind of real testing framework that was easy to use that was integrated in Java. Because some of the testing tools, like HP as a Mercury and some of these other, were good tools, but they weren't Java-based. You couldn't write they weren't JUnit-based. So testers used them, but developers were left out in the cold. So with Selenium tests, the way that we're running currently is we actually have a separate Jenkins job that runs Selenium tests. And in this case, it runs them against a development server. So the team publishes out their stuff to a development server and they run Jenkins tests against it. That's not bad, but the next level that we're actually moving towards is having the test actually start up the development server within the test. So if you use like Tomcat, there's embedded Tomcat mode. And so you can actually have a test that does this. You know, build your software, fires up Tomcat, installs it, runs your Selenium test, shuts down Tomcat. So that's even better because then you can actually do you can run a full Selenium test against every single commit or every single build for a web project. So that's kind of where we're moving for Selenium tests. Right now I've built stuff and I want to move it essentially automated. I want to move it from my maybe Nexus into an integration region. Maybe I run some automated tests and then if those pass, automatically pick it up and drop it into a QA region. People might run some QA tests, but then they come back to the system and click a button and say, yep, QA passes. And then maybe there's another phase in that same build pipeline where it says, okay, now manager really does have to approve it, because even though we might want to pretend like a developer sends stuff to production, there's certainly management approval comes in somewhere. And the manager clicks yes, and then it deploys to production. I call that thing your pipeline manager. I don't see a lot of products. There is a product from ThoughtWorks called Go, which does encompass that. And there's a book called Continuous Delivery, which really is that whole second half, which I think is awesome. And I really think that pipeline manager, it's not the tool that does the deployment. The chefs and the puppets of the world do that. It's the tool that orchestrates the deployment, which means it talks to chef and puppet, and it also allows manual steps, because you have manual steps. Even in continuous delivery, you're not checking in code and slamming it to production all the way. I don't see that happening anytime soon. There's got to be, somebody's going to do exploratory testing. But that tool that gives you visibility into where things are in that pipeline manager, actually I think where open source, you know, has a gap and where somebody's going to step in. It takes it, integrates the technical part of moving bits from machine to machine with the human workflow that inevitably has to be there. But that way, at least you're not sending emails or something. You go into a console and it shows your software. So
that's the main reason we moved from Antel Pro, or from Jenkins to Antel Pro. So that piece was missing from Jenkins.
So more getting into the deployment of it.
Yeah.
I think that's the really kind of wide open. And it's not as clear like what solution is going to win, and there's a lot of different ones. And there's still a huge gap for people to put in, you know, pieces that work well.
What we've done is we've got TeamSite that we were using for doing other stuff. So we've used TeamSite workflows to automate a lot of this. And then since we're throwing away TeamSite, we're looking at JVPN. We were looking at JVPN. Airship seems to be pretty good also. Not exactly for that, but for other pieces.
The coordination mechanism is entirely missing. Mm-hmm. So
CI system, the build system, the source control system, that's something that I'm trying to fix.
I wouldn't recommend necessarily the product. I've never used it, so I have no idea. But the concept is in a product called ThoughtWorks Go. So if you want to build your own, look at ThoughtWorks Go. Look at what they've presented, and either decide that's for you. Or I think ThoughtWorks Go actually incorporates the CI server and this whole pipeline manager and mushed it all together. And I like Jenkins, so I'm reluctant to change from there. But that whole visibility is definitely. So somebody here, write it, not use it. So that's all I have for today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our conference sessions on the podcast today. And thanks to Joel for allowing us to record his. You can find this and other podcasts, screencasts, and articles on our emerging technology site, emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com. And for Philly Emerging Tech enthusiasts, you can find just about all of our videos from ETE 2012 there as well, free of charge. Don't forget about our 2013 conference, held on April 2nd and 3rd. Session info and tickets available at phillyemergingtech.com. Our podcast themes are free theme number 3 and 4 from podcastthemes.com. Leave us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Send us a tweet at @techcast or to me personally at @krimple. For the Chariot Podcasts, I'm Ken Rimple.